Thank you, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. How are you all doing? Well, I'm really happy to be here tonight. Thank you for inviting me, and thank you for letting me see that entertainment. That was just awesome. I've seen a lot of skits. Various conventions do these, but this was by far the best. And it took all the great material and condensed it into a relatively short period of time, which is part of the trick of making that stuff effective. If you take that same material and drag it out for an hour, you find the audience is going, you know, this is was very good for the first 20 minutes. So that really went over well, and I enjoyed it immensely. My sobriety date is December 7th, 1964. And my home group is the Saturday Night Fever group in Tampa, Florida. If you're ever there, please come by and see us. It's a speaker meeting, and we have a lot of fun. And we'd welcome anybody from out of town, and if we know you're coming ahead of time, you will be one of the speakers. So. And so, Peggy M., over there, this is my 40th year of sobriety. She's already got hers. And in AA, that makes you an old-timer. And I've noticed as I travel around, they have these sobriety countdowns. It's getting where I'm the last one standing. And the next thing that happens after that is you die. And so I'm going to start sitting down at around 20 years. You know, let somebody else be the old-timer at the meeting. But one of the nice things is I've had the same sponsor for all these years. And in order to do that, you both have to stay alive. And so I have no idea what the record is for having the same sponsor the most number of years. But we're trying for it. And we'll see how we do. I don't know what made me think of this, but those of you with kids probably have observed this thing. That you will try to pass on your wisdom to your children. Now, son, I want to just tell you this. This is really important. And they look at you like, what the heck do you know about anything? And then about 10 years later, when they're in some school, some professor that they will suddenly be attached to, and they'll come running home, Dad, did you ever know? And they'll tell you the same thing that you were trying to tell them about 10 years ago, word for word. You know what I'm saying? Like they never heard it before. And it caught. And I watched that. I've got six kids, and I've watched that phenomenon take place. And every so often, one of them will come floating by visiting me, and you go, God, you know what, Dad? I'm, you know, some of them, they're in their 40s, all of them, and they'll spout out this piece of wisdom that they just learned. And I don't even say it anymore. I don't go, Chris, I told you that 25 years ago. Because they just don't want their parents to get credit for any of that. And so that let just, and I started thinking about that. And I started thinking about, you know, we come into AA and we go, boy, if only somebody had told me some of this stuff before. You know what I mean? And I've been thinking, you know, I'm getting older and older. And I'm looking back over my life. I think we were really told all this stuff way back when. Like I was told when I first started school, in secondary school. And, you know, if you want to get high grades, it's easy. All you have to do is attend every class. And for every class that you take, if you will study 30 minutes a night for the homework assignment, and do all the assignments, you will get an A. But, you know, some of us, I don't know about you, we go, okay, I accept that. I accept that as a truth. But could you get an A and not go to any classes at all? You know what I mean? It was like we took the information, but then decided that we could go beyond that. And we don't like to be told these things. We like to experiment for ourselves. So it's almost like, I mean, I'm sure when I was 6 or 7 years old, somebody said, listen, this is a very important lesson. Don't try to get through life without a higher power. I'm going to take you over to a church, and we're going to show you about this relationship. And then I got to AA, you know, 30 years later. I said, gee, I wish somebody told me about this higher power thing sooner. And so I think it's just normal for us to go blasting out. They give us all the answers. It's almost like, by the way, the combination to the lock is. And then we spent 30 years trying to unlock the lock and figure the combination out ourselves, because I like to get credit for my life. I don't want to pass it on to anybody else. I don't know if you're that way, but I like to think that I figured out everything important. And this is the collection of old ideas that we talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous that we have to get rid of. And I sure collected a lot of them. And they seemed very real and very true. And most of our speakers have been talking about feeling different. I just don't belong. I heard a speaker one time say he knew when he was about 20 that one of these days, when he was walking around out in the cornfield, that their spaceship was going to come down and these funny little creatures were going to come out and they're going to say, Ralph, you don't belong on this planet. There was a mistake. We didn't mean to put you here. Get in the spaceship. We're going to take you where you belong. And he said, I knew it. I knew it. I knew there was something different about me all these years. And, of course, so I had that feeling, and alcohol fixed it just like everybody else. That was why I'm an alcoholic, is because alcohol did things for me that it doesn't do for non-alcoholics. And you just don't see non-alcoholics if you ask them, tell us about alcohol in your life. They don't say, oh, it's the secret of life. They don't say that. They say things like, oh, alcohol, well, let me see. Well, you know, one of my favorite things, alcohol makes food taste better. Now, how many alcoholics you ever heard say that, you know? The reason I drink is because alcohol makes food taste better. And, I feel like asking them, is that going down or coming up? makes food taste better. It's just so strange. And so that was my case. As soon as I had my first drink in college, and I'd waited a long time, I realized I started much later than most people. Some kids have 5 years sobriety by the time they're 19 nowadays. But I was a late starter, but I worked very hard and got in a lot of trouble just in the first couple months of drinking. So I sort of caught up with some of the others. But alcohol became my secret weapon. And I was willing to do anything to always have that. I was very sick the next day. I felt awful. But I had experienced that first night of drinking a feeling that I never had before. And that was that I belonged. That I was much more than I thought. And you were much less than I thought. So you were no longer intimidating to me when I had alcohol. When I was sober, you scared the hell out of me. I looked out there and I could see in your eyes, number one, you didn't like me. And number two, you thought I was nothing. And when I drank, you suddenly approved of me and wanted to be my best friend. I could see that in your eyes. It was just like when I drank, the world became a great place to live in. And when I got sober, it got scary again. So to tell an alcoholic not to drink is to go stay in pain, restless, irritable, and discontent all the time with no break. And, of course, we say to those people, you don't understand. Alcohol is not causing me the problems. It's fixing my problems. So why would you take away the answer to all of my problems? Well, the rest of the people don't see it that way. They see us dry heaving in the morning and coughing up blood and getting arrested. And they go, looks to us like alcohol's causing you a problem. And from inside, there may have been some minor difficulties. You know what I mean? Just a little few unjust arrests and teeth missing and blackouts and those things. But from the alcoholic's point of view, that's a small price to pay for what we're getting from alcohol. And that was my deal. And if they were making a movie or something like that out of our stories, they would let us establish this relationship with alcohol, and then they would call us in and they'd go, "We want to formalize your relationship with alcohol. Would you be willing to give up your high grades for alcohol?" Yes, yeah, I'd be glad to give them up. "Would you be willing to give up all your athletics?" Yes, yeah, I'd be glad to give all that up. "How about your family? How about your health? How about your ability to earn a living?" Yeah, yeah, I'd be glad to give all that. "How about your soul?" Yeah, I'd be glad to give that up. And I just want to have access to alcohol, because as long as I do, I'll be able to get through life in fairly good shape. And that was what it looked like to me as a person who had only been drinking a relatively short time. I saw the world that way. So it's no wonder that we are willing to go through hell, literally, to keep this relationship with alcohol, because it's so important to us. If it wasn't that important, I wouldn't have put up with all this pain that we do. So sometimes society just doesn't see that. They don't see why in the world we would be willing to do this. And that's the answer, because it is literally doing something huge in our lives. Now, we have no idea what that huge thing is. And there's many things. I remember since I was first got sober, this, you know, Marty Mann started the National Council on Alcoholism. And in early AA, that was one of the first things. She drove Bill nuts breaking her anonymity in order to educate the country, but I think it got a lot of benefits out of it. And then it went on to become the National Council on Alcohol and Alcohol Abuse, and now it's a big bureaucracy. And every year they're coming up with some new thing about alcoholism. And they'll probably study it to death. And I think they'll find the answer to alcoholism just about the same time they find the answer to sadness. You know what I mean? Right around there. They'll just go, "Well, we now have the answer to sadness. Drinking." Yeah, okay. So it's a very evasive thing. You know, what is alcoholism? What are we talking about? And since there are so many, I mean, NIAAA's come up with so many, that it's just, as the years have gone on, it's just, this is my perspective on it. So it's just my opinion, just one guy's opinion in AA. But I really think this is what it is. We got to go back into the AA history to see some of this. And for those of you that are new, the reason I like to talk about the AA history is in order so that you can see the influence of a higher power on Alcoholics Anonymous, that this really was a divine plan, because the people who were trying to implement it were not trying to come up with what we have. They had much different plans. Making big bucks was one of them. And I suppose that the story really starts in Manchester, Vermont, in the early 1900s, when the four people got to meet each other socially. And the first one was a very wealthy young man from Rhode Island whose parents owned large businesses around the United States. And they had a summer home there, as did two of the others. And this young man was Roland Hazard. And he was destined to become very wealthy and take over the family business. And over from Albany, New York, was the son of the mayor of Albany. And I think they had three mayors in their family. The Thatcher family is really famous in Albany. They got a Thatcher Park and all of that. And that was Ebbe Thatcher. And they had a big summer place in Manchester. And so he was there and met Roland. And then right over from East Dorset was a young man named Bill Wilson, who was attending the Burr and Burton Academy. And so he had a chance to socialize with them. And then there was a young woman, the daughter of a Dr. Burnham, who came up from Brooklyn, named Lois Burnham, who was to go on and found Al-Anon. And so here they are. They're just to get to know each other. And then the story starts to unfold, and the first one who bites the dust, so to speak, is Roland Hazard. And they're trying to have him take over the business, and he wants to take it over. He's really a very serious guy, but he's a hopeless alcoholic. And no matter what he tries, he cannot stay sober. And so they tried just about everything that this country had to offer. When they came up with the idea that there was one last resort, probably the most powerful psychiatrist in the world, right next to Freud, Carl Jung in Switzerland. So since money is no problem, we can go to Switzerland and stay there for a year and let Dr. Jung work his technique on us. And at the end of a year, Roland had this final meeting with Dr. Jung, and he said, "Now, Roland, you understand, I have been trying to cause a personality transformation in you, and you just can't drink again, because that will mean that you end up in an institution, because you're a very hopeless alcoholic." And he said, "Well, thank you, doctor," and he got as far as Paris, and somebody asked him the wrong question. They said, "Hey, would you like a drink?" And he said, "Yeah, I'd love one." And it wasn't long until he was back with Dr. Jung. And he said, "Dr. Jung, I'm drunk again. What are we going to do?" And it was right here that whenever I see this part of our story, I think about the ending in chapter 5, the ABCs, that we were powerless over alcohol, couldn't manage our own lives. And Dr. Jung is B. No human power could have relieved our alcoholism, because if anybody symbolized the entire collection of human power as far as relieving alcoholism, it was Dr. Jung. And this is what Dr. Jung said to Roland. And it's probably why we all get sober, is that somebody says this to us. He says, "There's nothing I can do for you," which induces an absolute state of panic and hopelessness. I mean, that's the point of step one, is to induce such a state of surrender and hopelessness that we become willing to do anything. And that's where Roland was. He says, "You mean that's it?" And he said, "Yeah, you're probably going to be institutionalized. However, I have heard of a few cases, I read about them, where people like you have experienced profound spiritual, religious, I think he used that word, transformations. If I was you, I'd go look for one of those." And you can see, up until that point, Roland wasn't interested in pursuing a religious, spiritual transformation, and he suddenly was. And it wasn't because he saw a burning bush. It was because Dr. Jung explained the deal, you know, like the mafia might explain it to you. "Why don't you try for a spiritual awakening?" "Well, maybe I'll change my mind and I will." It was like a deal was made that he couldn't refuse. And so he went off, and the hot thing then all over the world was the Oxford movement. It was in. People were, "We're not going to let the churches do it. We're going to do it ourselves in our homes. We don't need the middleman. We can do this on our own," much like our AA meetings. And he found one of these when he came back to the States, and it worked. And indeed, he got sober, and he got happy, and he went on to become a very successful businessman. And it was right about this time that the second in the cast of characters came crashing down, and that was Ebbie Thatcher, who, of course, went on to become Bill Wilson's sponsor. And Ebbie's family had said, finally got so tired of his drinking that they said, "Ebbie, we're going to make a deal for you. Here's the deal. We're going to give you the summer home in Manchester if you promise to never come back to Albany." You know what I mean? And if you're a practicing alcoholic, that's not like a great deal. I got a home and money coming in, and I just never have to go see my family. And most of us don't want to see them anyway. So he became a main fixture in Manchester, and now became the year-round home. And he started having a series of events that started upsetting the public in Manchester. And then you read our history, you read about one day he was driving around in his car drunk and during the daylight, and drove into a farmhouse through the living room and crashed into the kitchen. And the lady of the house was in the kitchen, and he calmly asked her for a cup of coffee. So they get the sheriff and the judge and all that. Roland, you're going to have to straighten out. This is, one more time. We're going to have to do something. Oh, yeah, don't worry. Well, then another thing happened at the airport, and Bill and he fell out of the plane drunk, and that caused a bit of a problem. And then the final one was, and all of us can relate to this, the guys. You've been living in this house. You haven't done anything to it in years. And one day, you're just standing out in front, and you go, God, this house is a mess. I'm going to straighten it all out. I'm going to paint this thing. It'll really look good. And we go down, we go to this paint store and get a bunch of paint and some brushes and canvas and a ladder and a case of booze. To paint the house, you always need a case of booze at least. And then you go home and you really roll up your sleeves and you're filled with good intentions and you paint and you paint and you paint, and pretty soon you got maybe 10 by 20 feet painted. So you step back to admire your work and you get a couple drinks and a little comfortable chair and you just sort of watch the paint dry. I mean, you're kind of picturing the whole house painted and how, man, I am something, look what I'm doing. I'm transforming, blue, blue, just enjoying it. And some birds came by and crapped on the wet paint, which got him quite upset because he had worked very hard to do this. So he went inside and got a couple shotguns and sat out there guarding the wet paint until it dried. And any bird that came anywhere near the house, boom, he's just firing away. And the neighbors are quite disturbed by this. And so he finds himself in front of the judge, and he's going, Evie, I'm sorry, but we're going to have to send you off. This is et cetera, et cetera. And a couple of guys in the Oxford movement and Roland heard about it and came down and asked the judge, would you release Abby to the personal care of Roland Hazard? Well, my God, that would be like the Rockefeller family coming in. And the judge knew he wouldn't get any flack for releasing Abby to Roland Hazard. So off he went, and they took Abby to the Oxford group, and Abby got sober. And then we all know that later on, months later, as he got transferred down to New York City, he got thinking about his drinking buddy, Bill Wilson, and he said, God, I wonder how Bill's doing. He could sure use this. And made the phone call and went over to see Bill, and Bill offered him some gin, and Evie said, no thanks, no. And I found this wonderful spiritual thing, and Bill said, you can get rid of that spiritual thing by drinking. Evie, you don't want to have that, and you look very healthy, and I'm worried about you, and so why don't you have a drink? And Bill was in his, he had already been hospitalized twice and was no longer employable, and Lois was working in a department store, and Bill was stealing money out of her purse in order to buy gin. And that was the status of his life at that point in time. And so his next hospitalization, based on what Evie had said, he cried out for a higher power, God, if there is a God, please show himself. And he had a very profound spiritual awakening and went on to join the Oxford group and to try. Part of his spiritual awakening, it's just so inherent in all of us in these 12 steps. Part of achieving this channel that gets open to a higher power almost immediately comes the desire to give it away to the next person. It's a part of the package deal. And Bill had that in spades. And we see that a lot of new people. I mean, I sponsor guys, and then about right around 6 months sobriety, they'll come in and go, I think I want to be an alcohol counselor. I don't know if you have that, but I see that quite often. I go, don't worry, it'll go away. Wait about a year, see if you still want to be one. But it just seems to be part of, my God, this is so wonderful, I've got to give it away. It's almost like we know the only way to keep it is to give it away. And boy, Bill was out trying to sober up the drunks all over the place, and nothing was working. Until he met Dr. Bob, who had also found the Oxford movement in Akron. And they went on to adopt those principles and eventually separate from the Oxford group, fine-tune the Oxford principles into the 12 steps, and then we have this huge program. Now, about, I forget how many years later, maybe 15, Bill, even longer than that, 20, Bill realized that he had never told Dr. Young what had happened as a result of what he told Roland Hazard. And so he wrote the letter, and I'm sure if anybody's been around a while, you've seen this exchange of letters between Bill Wilson and Dr. Young. And if you haven't, you can call New York and they'll send you copies, or the Grapevine will reprint them at least every 3 or 4 years. And it's very interesting reading. And Bill wrote and said, "Dear Dr. Young, I don't know if you remember Roland Hazard, but as a result of your speaking with him and sending him on this spiritual quest, an organization called Alcoholics Anonymous was started as a direct result of your directions, and it is now worldwide, and we have X number of countries, and we have, you know, how many thousands, tens of thousands of AA groups, and because of your insight, we want to thank you for what you contributed to this organization." And so then Dr. Young wrote back and said, "No, I didn't know what happened to him. I'm so glad to hear about this." He said, "Now, when I was talking to Roland in the early 30s, it was not safe for me as a psychiatrist to talk about spiritual things because I would be laughed out of my profession. The other psychiatrists weren't quite ready." But he knew about spirituality quite deeply and felt it was inherent in all human beings, and it was part of any adjustment that you were going to make was the spiritual dimension. And he went on to say, and this, the whole point of me telling you this story is to come up with a new definition of alcoholism that comes out of our history. And he went on to say that the alcoholics that he had encountered, whether they realized it or not, were on a spiritual quest. That they had realized there was something missing inside of them, and it was troubling them greatly, and they were trying to fix it. And guess what fixes it? We found here in Alcoholics Anonymous. The only thing that fixes that thing that booze appeared to fix is conscious contact with the power of our understanding. And so if you were to interpolate what Dr. Young was saying is, alcoholics, now I believe everybody, when they are born here, probably has some discomfort inside of themselves as they go through life because they realize that there is a separation between them and their creator. And that someday we're going to have to close that in order to achieve total peace of mind. And in alcoholics, to paraphrase it, they miss God a lot more than the rest of the people. They just have this discomfort to a higher degree. And we go running around trying to fix it. I know there's something missing in my life. And so we look around in the regular world, and we go, "Well, what do you think will fix this thing?" And they go, "You got to get a lot of money. That's what'll fix it." I mean, you know, that's the most common thing you would hear. "No, you got a lot of money. Well, it's a lot of sex. That's really most of these problems are sexual problems, and it's just if you get a lot of sex, that'll probably go away." And if that doesn't do it, then you've got to get a higher place in society. And see, Bill writes about all these three things when we're doing our inventory in the fourth step: sex, security, and society. And we're all trying to fix this. We're trying to get there. And I never got anywhere in achieving any of these things. But when I talked to people who became incredibly wealthy, they said it didn't fix it. That there they are on their yacht with the same feeling, like there's still something missing in our lives. And so I just threw that out because we hear so many definitions of what alcoholism is. And I say, well, sometimes you can examine what the problem is by looking at what the solution is. And if the solution is to establish a conscious contact with a higher power, then maybe that was what the problem was. You see what I'm saying? You just work backwards. If this is what fixes it, then what was the problem? It was that I, without knowing it, had this feeling inside that something was missing, and I misdiagnosed my own problem. And, you know, that happens a lot. If you're new, spirituality just isn't going to look like the answer. I don't care who you are, it's not going to look like the answer. So I got here, my sponsor says to me, all right, I'm glad you're here. We've done the driver, you know, all the basic stuff, going to meetings, don't drink, and the shakes have stopped. I had been locked up in a nut ward. I was a Marine fighter. I'm not going to tell my story that much, but I graduated from Yale. I became a Marine fighter pilot because the Korean War was just ending and the draft was on. And I got married. I had 6 kids, and alcoholism was my primary job, and I had all these other things as a hobby. And eventually, I just couldn't even fly. I was so shaky, and I didn't trust the pilot of the plane I was in, which was me, and there was all these things. And so, I'll just tell one flying thing, and that was because I really believed that no matter what profession you were in, you experienced problems in that profession that no one else did. You know what I'm talking about? Like if you were a doctor and you're performing surgery in a blackout, and you come out of a blackout and you go, God damn. Is this an appendectomy or what? So the trick is, how do you ask what it is without them catching on that you don't know what it is? And my point is, they don't teach that in medical school because they don't think anybody will ever have that problem. And so that's what I mean by unique problems that only alcoholics have. And so I had one that for pilots that was not in the pilot training, nor was it in the handbook of the FA Crusader, which is the plane I was flying. And that was, what do you do if you're flying an F-8 photo plane during alcoholic withdrawals and you feel like you're going to lose consciousness due to this alcohol withdrawals, and you can't see the instrument panel anymore, and you can't do that. There's no place in the handbook, alcoholic withdrawals while flying the F.A. Crusader. You know what I'm saying? So you have to make up your own answer. That's what I'm saying. Us alcoholics, we come up with answers to very hard problems. And so I'm sitting in the plane panic-stricken because, God, what if I do pass out? You know, I'm going to die and all that. And I came up with this answer. I'm going to fly the rest of the mission with one hand on the stick. And I'm going to fly the other. My other hand's going to be on the ejection seat with a death grip. And my theory was, if I start to fall forward, I'll eject. And the plane will crash and the chute opens automatically at 10,000 feet. So I'll be fine. I'll make up a story about the oxygen ran out or something like that. And so I had solved the problem. And so I'm sitting in the cockpit, and part of me is terrified, but the other part is smug. You know what I'm talking about? Like, well, they almost had the old fox. But he's just too clever for him. You know. Of course, you can't tell this story to anyone. So it's just, and I'm sure that out here there's carpenters and bus drivers and whatever, nurses, who could tell stories where they had to solve a problem that was not in the handbook of whatever you were doing, because you're not supposed to have that problem. Anyway, I eventually had to go see doctors about, I flew for 12 years, and then it got so bad, I saw the doctors, there was no alcoholism in the Navy, so you couldn't be an alcoholic, and so they had to diagnose me with something else. After they studied me for 2 weeks of just looking at me, just all these different doctors, heart guys, stomach guys, psychiatrists, dentists, neurologists, and they study, and all they had to go on was, I'm very confused and disoriented. I'm covered with clammy sweat. I'm trembling. I'm very unsure of myself. I don't know what's going on, and I reek of alcohol all the time. You can just smell it. So the psychiatrist concluded that I was had childhood fear of flying that just showed up now. So I couldn't fly anymore, so the Marine Corps had to retrain me, and they made me an air traffic controller. So there's that's my story. Yeah. And that's what I did in the last year of my drinking, and fortunately I was overseas, and the senior enlisted men saw me and just said, Captain, welcome, you know, here's your tent, there's your little chair, coffee, and all that, but don't you personally go near the radar. And I agreed with them. I said, so that was where I was, and I got malnutrition and sick, and eventually had a grand mal seizure, and then was in the nut ward, and the DTs, and they're terrifying, and so I was locked up for 6 months, and then AA came in, and that's how I got to make the phone call to get my sponsor, and that started me down this journey. Went to a meeting every night for 2 years, and I didn't get promoted to major, and you have to leave. You're thrown out. And I remember having this resentment. I'm going, wait a minute, because of this new God that I'm learning about in AA, and I've been praying and doing all this stuff. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, let's see, God, I went to a meeting every night. I made coffee. I never said no. I did everything that was asked of me. And now you throw me out of the Marine Corps. So my 6 kids, we got no money. We got no career. All those years are wasted. You might say I had a resentment. And if you want to keep a resentment, don't tell anybody about it because they try to get it away from you, you know, like your sponsor or somebody. And I had that resentment cooking. It was enormous. It was the injustice of humanity. I mean, it was, and they are when they happen to you. They're much worse than anything that's ever happened to anyone else. And I would complain to God on a regular basis. Thank you, God. You're just great up there. I really appreciate it. Went to a meeting every night, and you threw my butt out on the street. I really want to thank you for being a loving God. I really am glad, God. You know, because when you get sober, stuff isn't supposed to happen. I don't know if anybody, if you're new, you know, and your wife is leaving you, you go, this isn't supposed to happen. I straightened my life out. Anyway, I was reading the Washington Post, and there's a little story about 6 months, 3 months after I was out. And it said, Marine Corps instruction team killed in plane crash in Denver, and it was my unit. If I had been promoted, I would have been with them on that plane. So if I had had my way, I'd be dead. Now, I read that, and I went, wow, that makes it look different. And, you know what I mean? And I also knew that God knew I had just read that. So I was going, okay, yeah, I know you saw me read that. And I think I mumbled something like, well, if you had just told me that was going to happen, I would not have been so upset about the outrageous nature of all these things. So anyway, we come to the spiritual part, which is the whole program. There isn't anything in AA that isn't spiritual. And you figure out, well, how are you going to get there? Now, we saw how Roland got there. He got there because Dr. Young said, there's nothing I can do for you. I mean, you got to come up against the ultimatum. I mean, that's what most of us do because our egos don't want to surrender. They just don't want to get willing. Willingness is the secret to everything. I mean, my God, if you just become willing, what you've eliminated is willfulness. And willfulness is so painful to just be willful. And boy, that's classifies an alcoholic. You remember? I remember the first time they said, self-centeredness is the root of our problem. And I said, you know, they're right. Self-centered is the root of my problem. And you know what I said right after that? I'm going to do something about that. You got it? Yeah, I'm self-centered, but I am about to fix it. I myself am going to fix self-centeredness. And if you think about that, well,
How are you going to do that?
Well, I'm going to become unself-centered. Over-centered. Yeah, but what is that? Well, I don't know. Maybe if I stood in the back of the room, I wouldn't be as self-centered. Maybe if I stood over there and I started thinking about it, I said, how the hell could you become unself-centered? And, of course, we find out there's only one way. You have to become God-centered. It's the only antidote to self-centeredness. And when we do, we are now operating from the real center. And everything looks different. That's what sobriety really is. Chuck Chamberlain, new pair of glasses. It just enables us to see what the real world is, and then it becomes comfortable. Instead of the world we made up with our old ideas and looking at it from a self-centered perspective. It was just like when the early people on this planet thought that the Earth was the center of the solar system. And they just believed that, and they had all the books said that. But when they looked at it, it didn't make sense. Well, if we're the center, how come that planet's moving over there, and how come this? It just won't compute with our mathematical formulas. And they about shot the people that were trying to tell them the truth. Because in order to move to the truth, you have to admit you're wrong. That's very hard to do. The first time my sponsor got me to do that, you know, where I kept insisting, you know, my ideas. And finally, I begrudgingly said, okay, Bill, you're right. And he said, no, you're wrong. I said, well, it's the same thing, isn't it? He said, well, let me hear you say it. And you should have heard the words. They would get up to... I could say he was right, but boy, was it hard for me to say I was wrong. You could hardly hear it. You go louder, louder, louder. So, for an early alcoholic to change his or her mind is like the Queen Mary doing a U-turn in the New York Harbor. It takes about 50 tugboats. Whoa, look at that. I just changed my mind. You want to call a press conference, you know, like, oh, look at me. Because we don't have ideas, we have convictions. You know, and if you ever change your mind, you're weak. And then we come in here and we go, if you don't change your mind, you're stupid. And so we come in and we just have all of this stuff that we see the world. And it's terrifying and it's wrong. It's just filled with wrong information. The only way to get out of there is to constantly be looking for another area that we're wrong about. That's the old timers go, what are you doing in AA? Six and seven. I'm looking for one more thing I'm wrong about so I can get rid of it. Because you suddenly realize the freedom of getting rid of wrong ideas. Because they just prevent us from being a spiritual entity so that we aren't blocking everything. So for those of you that are new, I think there's a deal. And it all comes back to Dr. Jung and the explanation of the problem. See, the explanation of the problem is what gets us in the door and gets us the open mind in the first place. And then, with an open mind, the rest of the steps just come in. I'm not going through the steps or anything, but I do want to go through what has been the greatest transformation for lots of new people in AA, and it's in the chapter of the agnostic. And if you're new, that's a great chapter to read. Now, see, I didn't know what that chapter said. I mean, I didn't read it, but I knew what it said early on. My sponsor wanted me to read the big book and all this stuff, and I knew there wasn't anything to help me in there. I'd been through the steps at least 50 times. I just scan, you know, like you're just looking for something. And there was nothing in there about getting money. There's nothing. There's no money step anywhere. There was nothing. And I knew that money was, they were knocking on my door. They were everywhere. And I wasn't going to be able to do anything until I got money. Then I could come back and I could be relaxed and I could look at this spiritual crap or whatever you wanted me to do. But money was, you know, that had to be addressed. That was, you could see, it was very clear. If you were in my shoes, that's what you would conclude also. So I was not pursuing anything. So I took my book and underlined some things and made some coffee stains and wrote wow a couple times so that if he saw the book, he'd be thinking that I was studying it and reading it and was really into it. And I saw that chapter of the agnostic and I said, oh yeah, I know what that chapter is. That's the chapter where they teach the agnostics how to stay sober. It's probably quite different from the rest of the people who are doing the steps, you know what I mean, the spiritual half of AA. Well, little did I know that the chapter, if you're new, I can tell you what the chapter of the agnostic says. It says, change your mind. That's what the chapter says. Become a former agnostic. That's basically what the chapter is saying. And so here's the exercise. If you're brand new and you're right on the fence, you're going, hey, I don't know. I can't, you know, I have a bad experience with God when I was little. I had a bad experience. I was about 7 years old in the Catholic Church. They had a crucifix about 20 feet high hanging from the ceiling, and I stared at it all the time. Everything was in Latin. My sister's sitting next to me. She's got 27 years in AA. She just thought it was a cool place. I thought it was the scariest place I'd ever been. And I was sitting there one day, and I had my own personal spiritual insight. You know, these things, everything was explained to me all by myself. And what the explanation was, I was staring at the crucifix, and it was like God's voice said, little boy, do you see that crucifix? Yes, I see the crucifix. Well, that's what I did to my only son, who I loved. Guess what I'm going to do to you? And I fainted right in the pew. And of course, I never told anybody because they would laugh at me. So I had my own secret truth about God, and I hoped I never died. I just never wanted to die because, boy, was it going to be bad. So now I'm here, and you're going, well, we got to get you a God. We go, no, we don't want to get me a God. I don't want to be a God. So how are you going to get a guy like that a God? How are you going to get him one? I mean, how are you going to get him to even consider it? So go into the chapter, and here we go. We go, okay, come on, let's settle down here. Let's see. Let's explain the disease of alcoholism. Okay, now see if you can buy into this. And I'm quoting out of the chapter. If when you drink, you have little control over the amount you drink. You in so far? Yes, yes. And if when you stop, you can't stay stopped. You still in? Yes, yes, we're all still in. Then you are an alcoholic. Oh, okay, so I'm an alcoholic. And here comes the clincher. If that be the case, you are suffering from an illness that only a spiritual experience can conquer. So now we have to say that sentence again. You are suffering from an illness that only a spiritual experience can conquer. And you go, whoa. And you want to go to the American Medical Association and go, how many diseases are there that only a spiritual experience can conquer? You know what I mean? Like, is there a section in the AMA directory under illnesses that only a spiritual experience can? You know, it's probably only one. And I turned to my sponsor and I said, but Bill, I don't believe in spiritual experiences. And he said, oh, you're screwed. Sorry. There's no other answer. What? Yeah. And you go right in the next paragraph. There it is. Here's your dilemma. You like dilemmas? The two rotten choices? That's what a dilemma is. Now you got this damn illness. And then it says, boom, to live on a spiritual basis or to die an alcoholic death are not easy alternatives to face. Now that should be a comedy line, right? So here you are. It's your day. You're on the quiz program. So you want to be an alcoholic. And there you are. You have a disease that only a spiritual experience would conquer. And there's two doors. And you have to choose one. Die an alcoholic death. Live on a spiritual basis. And guess what you do? Oh, man. Oh. 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 Is there a third door? Oh. Please. Ah. Can I make one phone call, right? On the quiz program? So you dial your doctor. Doctor, yes. Listen, I have a friend. He's curious. How bad is an alcoholic death? Because we don't want to go through the door marked spiritual experience. Why don't I want to go through the door? Because of my old ideas, I know it's going to be boring in there. Spiritual experience? What is that? Mother Teresa? Does she ever bowl? Did she ever go bowling? I mean, what is in the door? How do you know you'll have any fun? You'll probably never have sex again if you go through that door, spiritual experience. This is the dilemma that we find ourselves in. God, this is heavy duty. I thought you just come here to stop drinking. What's this spiritual door? And finally we find out there's no place else to go. And that's how we get spiritual. And if you're new, I'm going to show you how to get spiritual. You take out your handkerchief and you surrender. That's it. Okay. There's a lot of questions you can have as a new person. I suggest you just reduce them to one. You ready? This is the secret question that will guarantee you perpetual happiness. What should I do next? That's it. You just ask your group, ask your sponsor. You just keep asking. And as you ask, you will get guidance. And you will find the guidance is superior to your plan for living. You are going to get results beyond your wildest dreams. And you're going to begin the practice of opening up a channel for permanent guidance. And that's all this is. That's what eventually happens as we remove character defects that are blocking this guidance. That's all they are. They're just blockages. Once this channel is opened, we are getting guidance from a higher power. So the point of the program is not to teach us how to solve problems. Right in the big book, the purpose of this book is to enable you to find a power greater than yourselves which will solve your problems. Not you. The power will. Mainly the power solves the problems by giving you the power to see it differently. And you suddenly see that there aren't that many problems to start with. You suddenly see the truth and justice and love that's all over in the world. And without that power, we can't see it. And so this is the point of getting sober, is to achieve a status or a state where there's nothing for alcohol to fix. And if there's nothing for alcohol to fix, it's real easy to not drink. You follow what I'm saying? Because you're comfortable in your own skin the way you are. But we don't teach you how to get comfortable in your own skin. We teach you how to find a power that will make you comfortable in your own skin. These 12 steps are tools, but they're power tools. They have to be plugged in. You don't just go doing this stuff yourself. It's being done so that the channel gets opened. And this channel, I see as the prayer of St. Francis in the 11 steps. My favorite prayer in all of Alcoholics Anonymous is the prayer of St. Francis, 11th step in the 12 and 12. I like both books. I just swear they got to go together. They're wonderful. And it talks about St. Francis, he was like a crusader. He was out there whacking people and just raising hell way back, 700-800 years ago. And he suddenly said, I'm going to try the exact opposite of all of this. He was close to one of us, being screwed up and just trying to get straightened out. And he decided he would try to get rid of as much of his ego as he could. That was what he was trying to do, which is what the 12 steps are designed to do, is to get us out of the way and just have a channel to a higher power. And he probably got as far as many human beings have ever gotten. And when he did, he became a program of attraction. People wanted to be near his energy. Birds and animals just wanted to be near this energy because they could feel the grace of God, the power, the love, or whatever it is, when they were near him. They just wanted to be there. And that's what his prayer was. He said at the end of all this journey of what he did to deprive himself so that he could open this channel. And he said, this is the prayer that will help you more than anything. And then when you read it, it's, I'm miserable. What can I do about being miserable? It says, make me a channel of thy peace. And when I saw those lines, I pictured incorrectly what that would mean. I work the steps, I get this channel open, and then God's peace flows in, and I feel so wonderful at being in this planet and on this in this world. And I had it backwards. The channel opens and the peace flows out to other people. It's already there. Everything that we're seeking is already there. We just don't have access to it. You already are a wonderful, loving person. The thing that's causing you the most frustration is the fact that we're suppressing that, we're denying it, we're saying that we need something. It's just a misassessment of our problem. We only need to be giving. That's what's missing. We just need to open this up, and we suddenly find there's an infinite supply to give. Until the channel gets open, it feels like we're bankrupt and that we need something. Oh, there's so much missing in my life. What's missing is the channel isn't open so that it can flow out. And it turns out there's nothing missing. We all were born these magnificent creatures. If you're new, stop beating yourself up. You are one fine person. You are as much a creature of love as there is on planet Earth. You can't see it yet because you're looking through self-centered old idea eyes. You just work these steps that appear that they don't relate to anything, and you will have a new vision of yourself and the people around you. And you're going to find you are just marvelous. You're magnificent, and you've been given a rather special gift. You alone hold the key to helping the next person. They won't listen to non-alcoholics. They won't listen to anybody except another suffering person who learned the way out of hell. And when you walk there, remember how ashamed you were of your past? Oh, my God, I hate to think of my past. All those horrible things I did to my husband, to my children, to my family. Oh, God, I'm such an awful person. All of that horrible stuff is the reason you can help the next person. Your most precious possession are your past experiences, which you share with someone, and that's why they listen to you. So we don't want to close the door on the past. We want to be able to use that. So everything about you is going to be incredibly useful. You have a great future ahead of you. And the last thing I'll say is, I was in the Marine Corps. Steve was in the Marine Corps. We're very rank conscious. You know what I mean? So if I've got 5 days seniority on some other captain, I'm telling him, would you get my coffee, please? Alcoholics Anonymous is not quite structured that way. Have you noticed? The highest pay grade that we have in AA is servant. You start out as big shot. I'm a big shot. And then you come in here, and if you're very good, you work your way all the way up to servant. And that's the top of the line, is to get up there. So that all we think about is how we can pass this on. This is where happiness lies, is in the sharing of what we have been so freely given. So if you're new, I just tell you, don't give up. This is not just a stopping drinking. This is an epic journey in any definition of epic out of the dictionary. This is where your life transforms into something huge. And you suddenly realize that you have been given the greatest blessing in the world, which is a chance in the great fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and participate. Thank you all very much.